This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris is planning to visit the U.S.-Mexico border Friday as part of her effort to curb the surge in migrants attempting to enter the United States while examining the root causes of migration from Central America. Harris visited Guatemala and Mexico early this month, pointedly telling migrants, "Do not come to the U.S." But thousands of migrants from those two countries, along with those from Honduras and El Salvador, have been making long trek to the border, many on foot, escaping poverty and crime in their homelands. They say most of the migrants are coming from Latin America, but many are also coming from Ecuador, Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and some African nations. U.S. President Joe Biden vowed to reduce gun violence as he warned the nation about a dangerous summer spike in killings. Biden vowed zero tolerance for rogue gun dealers and those who traffic weapons from city to city during a speech Wednesday outlining a comprehensive government program. The Biden administration is to permit $350 billion in federal stimulus money to fund police departments in areas with rising violent crime rates. The president also said loopholes needed to be closed because there are too many people today who are able to buy a gun but shouldn't be able to buy a gun. Biden unveiled his plan after meeting with a bipartisan group of mayors, community activists, and law enforcement officials. The spike in homicides and shootings started last summer after cities began easing COVID-19-related restrictions. For more news, please join us at our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. By remote, this is VOA News. U.S. lawmakers debated into the night Wednesday over details of legislation aimed at curbing the power of big tech, that is, firms, with a sweeping reform of antitrust laws. House Judiciary Committee members clashed over a series of bills with potentially massive implications for large online platforms and consumers who use them. The legislation could force an overhaul of the business practices of Google, Apple, Amazon, and Facebook, or potentially lead to a breakup of the dominant tech giants. But critics argue the measures could have unintended consequences that would hurt consumers and some of the most popular online services. Debate of the bills remains unclear, with some Republicans and moderate Democrats expressing concern despite bipartisan support. Former Philippine President Benigno Aquino III has died. The son of pro-democracy icons who helped topple dictator Ferdinand Marcos and had troublesome ties with China was 61. Aquino was president from 2010 to 2016. His father was assassinated in 1983 while under military custody, and his mother led the 1986 People Power vote that ousted Marcos. Hong Kong's last pro-democracy newspaper closed its doors just before midnight Wednesday, ending 26 years of journalism. The company's remaining board members decided to close the paper earlier that day, following the arrest last week of five Apple Daily executives under the city's national security law. Authorities arrested one of its editorial writers on Wednesday. With Hong Kong's Security Bureau freezing the company's remaining financial assets and the paper's founder and owner, Jimmy Lai, in jail, the board had little choice but to fold. The owners and insurers of the giant container ship that blocked the Suez Canal for nearly a week earlier this year have reached an agreement in principle over their dispute with canal authorities. That's according to representatives Wednesday from both sides of the disagreement. Neither elaborated on what the agreement would entail. The dispute centers on the compensation amount the Suez Canal Authority is claiming for salvage of the vessel Ever Given, which ran aground in March, blocking the crucial waterway for 6 days. As always, for details on much more news, we invite you to join us on our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News. We'll be right back.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, June the 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. A bomb blast killed dozens of people Tuesday at a market in Ethiopia's Tigray region as new fighting flared up in areas outside the regional capital of Mekele. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is calling for investigations into the strike and other human rights abuses in the region.
We have made clear our position on the issues in Tigray. We have asked for a ceasefire. We've demanded a ceasefire. We've asked that the Ethiopian government allow for humanitarian assistance to be brought in to all areas of the country. Human rights violations that are being committed, people be held accountable for, and that Eritrean troops who are currently inside of Ethiopia should be asked to leave.
That's U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. Meanwhile, vote counting continues in Ethiopia after the country's national elections. In Uganda, the country's parliament will close for 2 weeks after 14 lawmakers tested positive for the coronavirus. Legislators are also voicing concerns about the high cost of healthcare in the country.
For the hospital directors of these private institutions to turn the situation of COVID-19 into a business entity, this is very unpatriotic and very inhumane.
Ugandan legislator Lilian Abar. In Zimbabwe, teachers are worried about their government's decision to defer reopening of schools due to the recent spike of COVID-19 cases. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, we start off in the Horn of Africa, in Ethiopia, where a bomb blast killed dozens of people at a market in the country's Tigray region as new fighting flared up in the areas outside of the regional capital, Mekele. At a press briefing at the United Nations in New York, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, reiterated the U.S. position on the conflict.
Well, I heard about that airstrike while I was in the room, and you might read the tweet because I called for accountability. I call for an investigation for what has happened. But more broadly, we have made clear our position on the issues in Tigray. We have asked for a ceasefire. We've demanded a ceasefire. We've asked that the Ethiopian government allow for humanitarian assistance to be brought in to all areas of the country. Human rights violations that are being committed, people be held accountable for, and that Eritrean troops who are currently inside of Ethiopia should be asked to leave. We have a special envoy who's working on this issue full-time. Secretary Blinken has also engaged on what is happening in Ethiopia. And as you know, we have addressed it in the council. I am disappointed that we have not had an open council meeting on the situation in Ethiopia, and I will be continue to push for that. It needs to be discussed. We are in a situation where the UN has indicated that close to 400,000 people are on the brink of famine conditions. And so this is an issue that we need to confront completely and wholeheartedly.
That was U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield. And meanwhile, vote counting continues in Ethiopia after voters went to the polls early this week in the country's national election. Life in the capital, Addis Ababa, is normal. But in the country's Tigray region, the war continues with new reports of airstrikes and military action. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch has been in Ethiopia for the past few weeks, and she spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson about what she's seeing and hearing. The conversation begins with an update on the vote counting.
The election board said last night that the preliminary results would be available in 5 days, and the official results are expected to be available within 2 weeks. But there are many places that have postponed their vote until September. And so, and it's postponing for security reasons, so we can also assume they're going to reassess later in the summer as to when exactly those votes are going to take place. We spoke to an analyst the other day who said that while it will take some time to get all of those seats filled to have people represented in parliament, he said the electoral map would not change based on these late votes. He believes that there will be a strong majority in parliament from this round of elections, and that will be enough to form a government.
Now, there are reports of new fighting in Tigray, including airstrikes. What are you hearing about that?
I just got off the phone with a young man in Tigray who is in the city of Adigrat. And that city, over the past few days, has, according to him, changed hands twice. There's been some violence there, but mostly without fighting. There's been reports, as you said, of airstrikes in other areas and roads closed. But in this city, what he said happened is that the TPLF, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, I guess now known as the rebel forces, but once was essentially the ruling party of Ethiopia for decades, they came back into the town after having been ousted by the Ethiopian government forces. And then, and not just that town, but other nearby towns, and Ethiopian forces withdrew within the following hours. So they had taken over overnight, and by lunchtime, Eritrean forces came into town, and the TPLF once again left. There wasn't actually fighting on the ground, as far as he could know, in the city. There was some violence. Some houses were destroyed.
What is the response in the capital about the fighting?
In the capital, it's actually surprising how little concern there is among many people. The people here in Addis are, of course, aware of the humanitarian crisis taking place in Tigray. A lot of people believe it is exaggerated and it is not as bad as a lot of the media says. I've heard from many people that the international media is biased and exaggerates claims of abuses in Tigray. They also, there's a lot of people in the capital who take the TPLF position very personally. The TPLF ruled Ethiopia essentially for decades, and the regime was repressive and sometimes violent. It was famed for locking up people who had different opinions, politicians, activists, journalists. So there's a lot of people that were victims of this regime that see the TPLF as just a continuation of the old regime, and the fact that they're fighting Ethiopian forces is the crime, not the suffering of the people. Or if the suffering of the people is the crime, it's the TPLF's fault, not the government's fault. So this is a pretty common thought in the capital. It's also, I think, to a lot of people here, very far away, and one of several conflicts. We've been focusing on the Tigray conflict as it's the most active and the most current war, but there are conflicts in several other regions. And so people in the capital think of the Tigray conflict often as one of several conflicts, as opposed to the large humanitarian crisis you see if you read a media report.
That is VOA correspondent Heather Murdock. She was speaking with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson. In Uganda, Parliament will close for 2 weeks after over 100 people, including 14 legislators, tested positive for the coronavirus. Lawmakers are also voicing concern over the high cost of accessing health services in private clinics during the second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic. They are calling on the government to rein in and stop private health facilities from what they say is an exploitation of the citizens. Reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji has more from Kampala.
Legislator Lilian Ebere says many private hospitals are charging exorbitantly to treat COVID-19 patients. She says she fears some citizens may die because they cannot afford such hefty charges.
It is totally uncouth for the hospital directors of these private institutions to turn the situation of COVID-19 into a business entity. This is very unpatriotic and very inhumane of them. You can't imagine that somebody is kept in the hospital at the ICU unit and is being asked to pay over $10 million per day. What kind of medicine are we buying to treat such people? There are even cases that someone is kept in the hospital on ICU claiming that they are still alive when the person died long time ago.
10 million Uganda shillings is about $3,000. Parliamentarian Dickson Kateshumba says the government must intervene immediately.
We are living in a liberalized economy. The private sector prays according to the demand and supply. But health is such an important issue that government should not look on. Government should not look on. We had the health minister mentioning that she's concerned and she was condemning the action, but that is not enough. I think there should be an intervention because most of the people are not able to afford. And we wonder why the health facilities here are exploiting Ugandans.
Abel says she's working with other legislators to petition the Prime Minister to stop the iniquity. Francis Chisirinya, the Deputy Director at Private Sector Foundation, says the charges are a reflection of the high expenses in treatment of COVID-19 patients.
Every patient is actually treated or attended to by at least five professionals, and each professional, the moment they get into to go to see this patient, they have to put on special suits. These suits cost about 75,000, meaning that this is already about 300,000 shillings. Now, added to that are the drugs that the patients are using.
Hospitals must also pay for other utilities like water and electricity, Chisirinya adds. Jordan Tumwesije from NGO, the Center for Health, Human Rights and Development, says the government is not doing enough to improve its health sector.
We cannot be in a pandemic and people are talking about constructing roads when people are sick and they cannot move. So I think it's a matter of really getting our priorities right.
According to this year's budget, the government reduced the health allocation by 0.5% to 5.5%. There has been a spike in the number of COVID-19 cases, prompting the government to impose a new lockdown. The country now has more than 73,000 confirmed cases, most of which are in Kampala and neighboring districts. The government has exempted essential tools used in diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of COVID-19 with hopes of reducing the cost of treatment charges. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Teachers in Zimbabwe said that their government decision to defer reopening of schools due to the recent spike of COVID-19 cases without vaccinating and providing them with PPEs will not yield much result. Columbus Mavunga has more from Harare.
Zimbabwe's Minister of Information, Monica Mtsangwa, says the government deferred the reopening of schools as COVID-19 cases rose by 127% since last week.
The surge is mostly attributable to the general complacence in adhering to the set COVID-19 preventive and precautionary measures, both in communities and at workplaces. In view of the regional and local upsurge of cases, the nation is informed that Cabinet approved the reopening of schools and other learning institutions be delayed by 14 days. Government will be monitoring the situation and a review would be made after 2 weeks.
Raymond Majongwe of Progressive Teachers Union of Zimbabwe was very brief in responding to the deferment of school reopening.
It's not like we must celebrate that schools reopening has been deferred or postponed. All we are saying is we are saying to government they're supposed to put the necessary precautions so that teachers and students are safe. We can't blindly walk into a trap. The third wave would be more fatal if we don't invest in making sure that teachers are safe.
Obed Masaraure, president of Amalgamated Rural Teachers Union of Zimbabwe, adds his voice to the issue.
our government has failed to capacitate our schools to adhere to standard operating procedures. So opening schools was going to be suicidal, as our schools are potential super spreaders of coronavirus. But outside tackling the COVID-19 pandemic, we also have the incapacitation crisis. Our teachers really are not able to teach because they are earning way, way below the poverty bottom line, which is short. Our teachers are living in poverty and they cannot even afford to pay school fees for their own children who are learners at the schools where they teach.
Robson Sheren, another teacher, says even if the government has promised to review their salaries, he still does not want to resume classes.
It's being incapacitated. The government should actually make sure that the time when they have deferred the opening of the schools, they provide PPEs in schools, because as I speak, in schools, there's no PPEs, and also the vaccination program was not visible. So they should be also vaccinating teachers during the time where there's deferment of learning, making sure that all measures are in place to safeguard the teachers and the learners as well from the pandemic.
Zimbabwe has been affected by shortages of COVID-19 jabs since last month, but Information Minister Mchangwa says that will be addressed soon.
On procurement of COVID-19 vaccines, arrangements are currently in progress to procure 2 million doses of vaccines from China. These are expected in the country by end of month. Furthermore, 500,000 doses of vaccines are expected to be delivered this Saturday, the 26th June 2021.
So far, 716,056 Zimbabweans have received their first shots and 451,793 have received their second. Zimbabwe has 43,408 confirmed coronavirus infections and 1,692 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the global outbreak. Columbus Mavunga for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Thursday, June the 24th. The government of Germany recently formally recognized that its killing of thousands of Herero and Nama people, two ethnic groups found in Namibia, was a genocide. The killings carried out between 1904 and 1907 have been termed as the first genocide of the 20th century. Dr. Elizabeth Baer, author of the book The Genocidal Gaze from German Southwest Africa to the Third Reich, contends that the perception among colonial powers at the time that Africans were subhuman, lacking of any civilization and history, was used as justification for the violence against them. She says that even though Germany has agreed to pay $1.3 billion, many are questioning the agreement, which refused to use the terms reparations or compensations, with no direct payments going to descendants of the Herero people. Instead, most of the money will be used to buy back their ancestral land forcefully taken by the Germans.
There's a lot of controversy on the ground in Namibia about Germany's offer to acknowledge the genocide and to give the equivalent in American dollars of $1.3 billion to Namibia for development purposes. Why is there controversy? First of all, the agreement is between the governments. Even though some Herero and Nama people have been going to Germany and negotiating for this, 9 rounds of negotiations since 2015, but still there's no direct payments to the descendants of the Herero whose land was stolen a century ago. The money's going to the government. Some of the money, about 50% of the money, in fact, is going to be used to buy land back from the Germans. But this is land the Germans stole to begin with. So it means then the money will go back to the Germans, right? Namibian government pays Germany for the land, and it goes back to the Germans. Some of the other money is allocated for vocational education. Some Namibians find this to be very condescending. Why aren't they giving them a college education instead of just assuming that their abilities are only at a vocational level? So, and then there's among the Herero and Nama, there's distrust with their government. And this is a political party situation. So Namibia was the last country in Africa to gain its independence. Namibia did not gain its independence until 1990. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the political party that succeeded in gaining that independence, SWAPO, worked very hard. It fought wars for many years against the South Africans to get the independence. But SWAPO and the Herero and Nama people do not always get along politically. And the Herero and Nama people were decimated in terms of numbers because of the genocide. SWAPO is much more powerful. So again, there's fear among the Herero and Nama that they will never see this money. I read a lot of posts on Namibian Facebook. One man said, "The government will build a one-inch building and tell us it cost $1 billion, and we will never see the money."
So there's no trust or even representation by the Nama and Herero people.
Exactly.
When it comes to, you know, being recipients of this the $1.3 billion figure.
Right.
Let me ask you this real quick. First, how long did the negotiations take, and how did they arrive at this $1.3 billion figure? And why is Germany hesitant to call it, or to call the offer, reparation?
They don't want to call it reparations because one of the terms of the agreement is this is their final and last offer. They were making this offer. This is all they were going to offer. They say Namibia can never come back to them for further reparations. So they're calling it a development fund, not reparations, which then allows them to make this agreement between the governments and not with the people who are the descendants of those who were murdered.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, they're really skirting, they're still skirting responsibility. Even if they're giving this money, they're not really being taking full responsibility or acknowledging.
That's right. That I think that's right. Symbolically, some Herero and Nama have said this acknowledgement gives us back our dignity, even though we think the money is not enough. And I do think symbolically it is important that Germany finally acknowledged, yes, it was a genocide. But I don't think that how they're handling the financial end of things is appropriate. And just to give you a sense of comparison, $1.3 billion in American money, but in euros, which are more valuable than American dollars, Berlin alone, the city of Berlin, spends over $10 billion a year in personnel costs. So while $1.3 billion may sound like a lot of money, from the German point of view, it's a pretty modest sum.
It's a drop in the ocean, really.
And they're going to pay it out over 40 years. So again, the value of that money will drop over the 40 years.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is the end of the conversation on this issue as far as Germany is concerned. Since it's not being called a reparation, it's a development fund, and the Namibian government has signed on to it. This is it. No more talk about reparations.
That's right. There's been a very difficult recession in Namibia, and the government really needs money. And I think that's one of the reasons they were motivated to accept this offer right now. But whether it's going to make a difference on the ground to people who whose families suffered from this is unclear.
That was Dr. Elizabeth Baer, author of the book, The Genocide of Geds, From German West Africa to the Third Reich. And that's it for this Thursday, June the 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Ricky Shryok, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good day, Africa.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Next up, the reparations debate. Should descendants of slaves be compensated for the free labor their ancestors were forced to render during slavery? We talk with two analysts who spar over the renewed push for reparations in America and discuss some contemporary experiments taking place in states and cities across the country. That's Encounter this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.